So in the annals of the Buddhist teaching, and in the annals of Buddhist sutras, teachings that are purported to be given by a Buddha, an authentic Buddha, the Vimalakirti Sutra is quite unique. Primarily because the major protagonist of the sutra is not the Buddha, Shakyamuni. It is the layman, the householder, the Vimalamitra. There is no other sutra like this. And so therefore, as you could imagine, even though it is a sutra that came from India, because I read recently that they did find a Sanskrit version, it was primarily known in translation in China, Korea, Japan, somewhat in Southeast Asia, and Tibet, where obviously it had great significance for lay people, obviously, and was especially deeply respected in the Zen tradition. And you'll see why as we as we enter this profound sutra. It is also enjoyed because there is a not only incredible wisdom in it, but there is also great drama in it and humor in it, as you will see. So, why don't we just read it together and see what it's about. It begins like all sutras, the beginning. Here he translates it. And by the way, I'm translating from the Burton Watson translation. There is an older translation by Robert Thurman that probably more people are familiar with from the 70s. This was done in the 90s by Burton Watson. I like it better. Thurman's is translated from the Tibetan. Watson's is translated from the Chinese. And it flows a little, I think, more easily, the verbiage of his translation. But Thurman's is an excellent translation as well. So this is chapter one. This is what I heard, and again, as most of you know, the thus I have heard is usually the beginning of all sutras because it connotes that this was heard from the Buddha. After the passing of Shakyamuni, at the first Buddhist council where his disciples came together to codify what was an authentic teaching of the Buddha. And we know the Buddha's cousin and attendant Ananda, who had a perfect memory, was one of the major ones who had memorized so much the Buddhist teachings. But the kind of code of the first Buddhist council that was held at Rajgir was this little beginning, thus I have heard. And so this was heard by Ananda, this was heard by the early disciples, this was an authentic teaching of the Buddha. So this one begins, thus I have heard. At one time the Buddha was in the Amra Gardens in the city of Vasali. And this is, again, setting the place. The Amra Gardens in Vasali, you can go there today. Vasali is no longer called Vasali, but there are relics of Buddhist temples and monasteries. It was one of the major places where the Buddha visited. And the Amra Gardens, or the Mango Gardens, was given to the Buddha by Amrapali, who was a courtesan. It was a little controversial at the time for the Buddha to accept the offering of this garden by this wealthy courtesan of the town. But the Buddha was beyond such matters and gracefully accepted it from her, and she was a disciple of his. So there he was, the Buddha, in the Mango Gardens in the city of Vasali, accompanied by a multitude of leading monks numbering 8,000. Well, again, these, for those of you who are maybe more familiar with the Theravada tradition and Theravadan suttas, the Pali canon, you'll see something very different begins to unfold here in the first chapter. Because in the Pali canon and in those sutras of the Pali canon, the protagonists are always the Buddha and his disciples and lay people. You'll see the audience in Mahayana sutras is quite different. And the numbers are quite different. So these are a multitude of leading monks, not just ordinary monks, leading monks, numbering 8,000. There were also 32,000 bodhisattvas, all known to the assembly. 8,000 leading disciples, 32,000 bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are what? Bodhisattvas are enlightened beings who not only, and again, their understanding will now be described, but in the Mahayana they are considered higher than the disciples, higher than the arhats, because one, they have postponed any thought of leaving the world of samsara, leaving the world of suffering for their own benefit, but have made the commitment to stay in this saha world for as long as necessary until all beings have been liberated. And as you can see, when they say 32,000 bodhisattvas, they don't describe them as monks or nuns or male or female. They are bodhisattvas, enlightened beings. All were known to the assembly, persons who had carried out all the basic practices of great wisdom. Now, it says, sustained by the might and supernatural powers of the Buddhas, they accepted and upheld the correct law in order to guard the citadel of Dharma. So now we're beginning to get teachings for ourselves about what this practice is about. Sustained by the might and supernatural powers of the Buddhas. The Buddhas are what? Fully enlightened beings. How are we sustained by their might and powers? Interesting. Well, obviously, to have that kind of sustenance, there has to be a connection. Right? How are trees sustained by the earth? They have to be rooted deep in the soil of the earth, don't they? So the nurturance, right, of the earth can flow into their roots and sustain the wondrous growth of the trees. So practitioners of the way, practitioners of the Bodhisattva way, have to root themselves in this great lineage of awakening and have to feel a connection to this vast awakened energy, to this vast energy of wisdom and compassion that has manifested and continues to manifest in the world through beings. And in many ways, it is through our reading of the Buddha's teaching, reading the lives of the masters, by attending retreats, by doing the kind of ceremonies and rituals and chanting and prostrations that we do, is the way we connect, not just intellectually, but emotionally, with this tradition. All the great masters that I have known, they are not just philosophically involved with Buddhism. because they love Dharma. It's a love affair. It's an affair of the heart. It's that kind of connection that sustains bodhisattvas and gives them their might, gives them their strength, their confidence. It is a confidence and strength that goes beyond one's individual experience. It is something that embraces the experience of a living, ancient, endless tradition of practice and awakening. So it's very important. They accepted and upheld the correct law, that's the Dharma, its teachings, practices, realization, in order to guard the citadel of Dharma. Beautiful language. We'll see a lot of poetic language. So that's one of our jobs, okay, as bodhisattvas. Not simply to practice, but to know it is our duty to guard the citadel of Dharma. Soldiers guard the citadel, right, to keep it safe, to protect it, so it will continue, right? That's their job, to guard the citadel, so it will endure. Bodhisattvas guard the citadel of Dharma. Why? Protect it, to keep it safe, to keep it pure, to keep it alive. Why? So it can continue generation after generation after generation to be available to beings to help them, to ease them in their life, and to bring them goodness, to free them from their sufferings. So, how do we guard the citadel of Dharma? We guard it through the purity of our practice. That's how we guard it. We keep it pure. We don't sully it. We don't contaminate it. We don't dilute it. But we continue to treat it as something precious and rare and wondrous in this life. Because it is. So in a certain sense, bodhisattvas, or the Buddha's army, but I think I'm getting a little carried away. But if you think about all the energy that society has put into warriorship, protection, of what? Of land, of territory, of boundaries, of things, endlessly dying, killing each other for what? Over anything of real sustenance, real meaning. So, by seeing the way, the intensity, the way people, so many people are willing to put such energy and commitment, even give up their own lives, of the things that ultimately are of no value, how can we not if we think that we have something here that truly is precious and valuable to humanity, to the planet, to the world, to animals, to plants, to minerals, how can we not be as committed to guarding the citadel of Dharma? They know how to roar the lion's roar. So we're going to practice us. And their fame resounded in the 10th direction. The lion's roar is a quite a well-known expression in Buddhism. Actually, we'll see where they get to this time, but there's a great lion's roar of Finlakirti that we'll get to. But the lion's roar is a great analogy, because it is said that in the jungle, when the lion roars, all the other animals are silent. Something's up when the lion roars, and all the animals stop and are silent. It's a very powerful roar. But it says the Buddha's teaching is like that. The words of truth have a certain power that stops the ongoing meanderings of the delusive mind. So these old bodhisattvas, all of them had, they knew how to do the lion's roar, and their fame resounded in the 10 directions. Without waiting to be asked, they befriended others and brought them comfort. Sweet description of a bodhisattva. They did not wait to be asked. If they saw someone in need, if they saw many in need, they didn't wait to be asked. They befriended others. So you can see the bodhisattva is not somebody who withdraws from the world. It is not somebody who is indifferent to the world. It is not somebody who is cold and remote in their personality. But the bodhisattva is friendly. Right? The bodhisattva is friendly and offers friendship, companionship, comfort, aid, unstintingly to other beings. This is a bodhisattva. They ensured the continuance and prosperity of the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, making certain that these never expired. So again, Why do we bow? Why do we prostrate? Because we are grateful. The only reason we, those of us sitting here in North Carolina today, are able to practice is because why? Because of past generations of practitioners. It is only because of their efforts, right, to preserve and practice the Dharma that we can practice. You know, why do we have the teachers that those of us have in this lifetime who have taught us and inspired us? Only because of their teachers. So, to understand that each of us are part of that continuation, are part of this transmission, and that our practice is part of that capacity to continue to transmit the Dharma and preserve it so it will be there for our children and grandchildren and on and on and on. It will always remain. It is considered a sad world where there is no Dharma. And when I say Dharma, I don't only mean specifically the Buddha's teaching. I mean, teachings that have the capacity to liberate beings, to show them the way in this life. toward goodness and wholeness and wealthiness. If you go to societies and places where these kinds of traditions do not exist, you find great suffering. The way people interact and treat one another. Great darkness. So it's important that we remember that that we are not just practicing for ourselves, but we are practicing for the benefit of others, but not just only the benefit of others horizontally, people who are alive today, but also part of our commitment to the ongoing life of the human species on Earth. And as we find out, this is not the only place where Buddhism is going on. They conquered and subdued the ill will of the devils and curbed the non-Buddhist doctrine. Good. They conquered and subdued the ill will of the devils and curbed the non-Buddhist doctrines. What does that mean? What are these devils? To have ill will. They're simply the devils of egoism, the devils of self-centeredness, the devils of exploitation, manipulation. All those are the devils that need to be subdued. They're not external devils. They're all the mischief makers without our own consciousness that are up to no good and simply seek their own self-fulfillment without caring one iota about the well-being or the effects on others. These are the devils. And any kind of teachings that support the continuation of egocentricity or any kind of wrong views that lead people into all kinds of dead ends and paths that are non-productive of healing and transformation. We could say these are quote-unquote non-Buddhist paths. Please don't take this in a dogmatic way. Right. It simply means that there are many teachings in the world, many philosophies in the world, that purport to have something of benefit to beings, but actually do not produce that. And it's not as if they have to be outlawed, right? But one should, I remember once giving a talk, and I was reading from one of the Chinese masters. And this master was railing against certain types of Zen practitioners. And afterwards, the person asked the question. He said, "This is so un-Buddhist. That there's not, not supposed to be any judgment and acceptance of everything. How can this?" And I said, "Well, this is a teacher." And he was giving a public talk, to students. And teachers have a duty to point out, right, not only the right way, but also to warn their students about the wrong ways. Right? A music teacher has a right to show their students how to hit the right notes, but also a duty to tell them which are the wrong notes. So there's nothing harmful in that, that's helpful in that. Again, if the student just wants to go around hitting wrong notes, that's that is their freedom, I guess. But for the teacher not to point out the wrong notes would be derelict in their duties. And therefore, teachers will often warn their students about paths and ways that don't really lead to liberation and healing. So that's simply what this means. So please don't take this as a call to evangelism, and we're not going to march out of here attacking heretical doctrines. All were spotless and pure. Having long ago rid themselves of snares and obstructions, their minds constantly resided in a state of unhindered emancipation. Okay, I think we can do this in this retreat. There's really nobody bugging us. There's really nothing negative coming our way, right? Nobody giving us a hard time. We're not listening to talk show radio and getting all riled up. Everything is very peaceful here, isn't it? Everything is very calm here, isn't it? Everything is very beautiful here. So I say, in this ideal circumstance, why don't we practice being bodhisattvas, just like these men and women? Can we not be spotless and pure? And rid ourselves of snares and obstructions, their minds constantly residing in a state of unhindered emancipation. Emancipation. Come on. Egocentricity. And judgments and evaluations. So much wasted thought. Freedom from feeling separate and disconnected. By letting go of the things in the mind that create that sense of separation and disconnection, and using the practice of mindfulness to connect, to touch deeply the reality of everything that we're experiencing. What's being talked about here. Please don't turn it into some kind of metaphysical alternative universe that only a certain kind of deeply enlightened beings get to get entrance into. Bodhisattvas do not live in their own Disney world, their own Bodhisattva world. Bodhisattvas live in the same world that we live in. But through their training, they have emancipated themselves so they can live at ease in the world. Their mindfulness, meditation, retention of the teachings, and eloquence never faltered. And of almsgiving, keeping of the precepts, forbearance, assiduousness, meditation, wisdom, and the power to employ expedient means, there was not one they were deficient in. Just like a checklist. We're all checking ourselves. How are we doing? We're doing on this path. And these are not just descriptions. These are teachings we've been giving. We're told these are the practices and the characteristics and the realizations of bodhisattvas. And again, Each of these things we are doing. Is that clear? We are practicing all these things. And the only difference between us and these fully realized bodhisattva is the consistency of the practice. We practice mindfulness, we practice meditation, we do our best to retain the teachings, we hope to be somewhat eloquent in our sharing of teachings. We practice generosity, we practice the mindfulness trainings, we practice patience, we practice being energetic, just being energetic in our practice, we practice concentration, development of understanding, and the power to employ expedient means. And there'll be a lot more about expedient means. But these are all the practices that we do. And the capacity to do them more and more is the only thing that separates us from more realized beings. Which means what? That we, each of us, have that capacity. Right? If we train with the same energy and commitment that these men and women did. They had learned to accept the fact that there is nothing to be grasped at, no view of phenomena to be entertained. It's a very pregnant line here, isn't it? How many of us can say, sitting here today, that we have learned to accept the fact that there's nothing to be grasped at? How simple that is. Can you see how elegant that is? Oh. Right? If you look at all your troubles, all your ill at ease, all your emotional ups and downs, all your obsessions, you go up. Oh, it's because I still haven't gotten it that there's nothing to be grasped at. We could stop right here. I mean, can you see how simple this is? That's it. You know, we get asked, why don't I just get it? There's nothing, there's no thing to be grasped at. So if I stop grasping, then what? Stop grasping at what? At any of the objects of the senses. Objects that we see, objects that we hear, objects that we smell, objects that we taste, objects that we feel, and objects objects that we cognate. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions. Those are all objects of the six senses. When am I going to get it that since there is nothing permanent or self-existent in any of that, right, I don't need to grasp at anything. I can just let things arise and pass away as is their wont. End of talk. End of search. They have learned to accept the fact that there is nothing. Please remember nothing. And every time that grasping mind of yours says, oh, but how about this? Or this one's, you know, I know about the others, but this one is worth grasping at. Right? Your grasping mind is always trying to rationalize and make a deal with you. That this is different. This situation is different. Right? This is important. Worth holding on to, worth grasping. Like the fish with the hook. But if we look clearly, with the eyes that see clearly, we'll see that there's no thing to be grasped. And so therefore we can what? Relax. Let go. Be at ease. no view of phenomena to be entertained. Phenomena is what? That's dharmas with a small d. Anything, any object of the six senses is phenomena. Since they don't inherently exist, why do we have to endlessly create views about them? I like this and I don't like that. I'm a this, I'm not a that. She's a this, he's a that. This is that. This is beautiful, this is ugly. This is good, this is bad. This is high, this is low. This is right, this is wrong. Endlessly we entertain views about phenomena. Right. I think it's a nice word. Entertain. Right. Entertain means what? If you're saying, I'm going to entertain some people, what does that mean? You can invite them over, right? Hang out with them a while, we're going to talk. Entertain. Something's entertaining. When you say something's entertaining, means it's what? It's it keeps us amused. Or just pass the time. We entertain ourselves with our own views, our own perceptions, our own thoughts. We invite them to dwell within our mind, and we have a rollicking good time with them. Until it turns bad. And then we want to get rid of it. And we wonder why we got sucked in again, why our practice is so weak. We don't realize that the problem was at the front end. It's a front end problem. I should have never entertained them to begin. Right? We should have never invited those people over. We should have never invited them to stay with us for 3 days. Right? There's nobody to blame but ourselves. Can you see that? When we do that with our own mind, we invite this stuff in, and we let it entertain us. In the beginning, we think it's wonderful or benign or meaningful or purposeful. And there's always a hook. And once again, we're caught. And once again, we have to untangle ourselves, like that poor thresh and the fish. Trying to get unstuck from that hook. If only it had never bitten. If only it had seen the hook in the lure. How much easier life would be for that little fish. So we're like that. Thoughts, feelings, perceptions always arising and passing away in our mind. And rather than just letting them rise and pass away, we bite, we entertain, we get hooked. And there we go again, thrashing about in another drama of our own creation. They have learned to accept the fact that there is nothing to be grasped at, no view of phenomena to be entertained. I wonder if we could just put that across the front of the meditation hall. It'd be great. We can get a banner. Nothing to be grasped at. No view of phenomena to be entertained. That could be a good mantra for our retreat. Right there. Do we have any calligraphers in the room? They knew how to respond compliantly to others and to turn the unregressing wheel of the law. This is so beautiful. There's so much wisdom in these phrases. Right? They knew how to respond compliantly to others. We, on the other hand, what? We want everyone to respond compliantly to us. Right? That's our deal. We look around the universe, we look around the people in our lives, we look around life situations. We want all of it to comply with our will, don't we? Our needs, our wants, our will, our expectations. Bodhisattvas respond compliantly to situations. Very wonderful. They're responsive. They're not demanding response. They're not manipulating the world to conform with their needs and wants. So they don't suffer, do they? They can be open-hearted and at ease. Again, through our practice here, you know, can we learn to respond compliantly to the unfolding of retreat, to the unfolding of situations? Right. Schedule. Can I respond compliantly to the way I feel, don't feel? The weather, the food, people next to me? Or am I going to stand apart, rigid and judging? Trying to manipulate things to go my way. Upset, disturbed when they're not. They knew how to respond, comply to others, and discern the unregressing will of the Lord, expert in comprehending the characteristics of phenomena. Able to understand the capacities of living beings, they towered over the others of the great assembly and had learned to be fearful of nothing. Very powerful. So you understand now why I said we may not get through this whole sutra. We're still not through the first page. But there's so much here. Can you see? There's so much wisdom. The characteristics of phenomena. What are the characteristics of phenomena? Remember the three marks of existence for those of you who study Buddhism? Impermanent, empty of self, self-existence, and characterized by suffering, dukkha. Anicca, anatta, dukkha. The characteristics of phenomena. They understood them. They understood the capacity of the living beings, which will be explained more. They towered over the others of the great assembly and learned to be fearful of nothing. For those of you who live with fear, for those of you who live with anxiety and worry, please hear the lion roar. To understand the characteristics of phenomena is to be fearless. To understand the empty nature of all phenomena, including self and other. To be fearless. To see beyond the labels of birth and death, and sickness and an old age, is to be fearless. To experience the inherent well-being of the mind. Is to be fearless. So this is all this type of fearlessness is readily available to all of us through this practice. With their merits and wisdom, they discipline their minds, they adorn their bodies with auspicious signs, ranking foremost in aspect and form, but rejected all worldly embellishments. In fame and renown, they soared higher than Mount Sumeru, their profound faith was diamond-like in its firmness. The jewels of their dharma shone everywhere, raining down sweet dew, and among the assembly, the sound of their words was the most subtle and wonderful of all. Sort of like our group here. The jewels of their dharma shone everywhere, raining down sweet. They have plumbed the depths of dependent origination and have cut off all erroneous views. No longer entertain the concepts either of being or non-being. So the, you know, dependent origination is simply means what? That nothing exists separate unto itself. Everything is dependent on causes and conditions. Everything is interrelated with everything else. To have that view, to plumb the depths of dependent origination, is to truly understand the unfolding of this world, the unfolding of oneself, the unfolding of others, and gives the capacity for profound acceptance and understanding. It disabuses us of blame and guilt and hatred and anger, and allows us to truly see the interconnectedness of everything and the reasons why things are unfolding the way they are. So we then have the capacity of acting and interacting with life in an intelligent and skillful and compassionate way, rather than being driven by emotionality. So understanding this is another key part of... They didn't entertain the concepts of being or non-being. They were fearless as roaring lions. And their disquisitions on the Dharma rolled forth like thunder. In seeking out the jewels of Dharma, they were like practice pilots at sea. That's a nice one. How many of us can say that? That really in this life, we are always seeking out the jewels of Dharma. Like sea captains, very accomplished. Like crossing the rough seas. Seeking treasures. Fearless. Adventurous. Can you get a sense of that analogy? Treasure seekers, those who sought new lands, they cross great oceans, go through all kinds of hardships, and have great adventures in seeking a worldly wealth or power or fame. Bodhisattvas, they're like that, but they seek jewels of Dharma, jewels of wisdom, jewels of insight, jewels of authentic experience. And they're willing to go anywhere and everywhere, have all kinds of great adventures in their pursuit of the jewels of Dharma, jewels of awakening. They had mastered all the profound and subtle meanings of the doctrines and were expert in perceiving the past and future existences of all living beings and the workings of their mind. So these are also characteristics of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And again, perceiving the past and future existence of living beings and the workings of their minds is so essential if we're going to help someone, isn't it? So, I mean, again, you know, we can say that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have this capacity to see into past lives and future lives, so therefore can understand the full unfolding of someone's life. But even we, right, in our own little way, whether it's encountering our own difficulties or sufferings, or whether being helpful to others in counting their difficulties and sufferings, we can see if we want, you know, to what? To be open, to listen, to be objective. Right? We also can be willing to what? Understand the causes and conditions from the past that have created the situations that are unfolding in my own life or in someone else's life. And one also can see, if one is willing to step back and be somewhat objective, how the causes and conditions that one is creating in the present may be affecting or moving our life in a certain direction, therefore creating the causes and conditions for how the future will unfold. So, I mean, we could say that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have grander capacities, but we can all understand that, can't we? And to say, oh, I can develop that capacity, can't I? I can learn to really listen deeply to other people. I can I can be willing to get beyond my own judgments and criticisms and evaluation in others, to really tease out from them their path, so I can understand clearly why their life condition is unfolding the way it is in the present. I can look deeply into the causes, the situation, the way I'm acting, thinking, behaving myself or someone else in the present, and to clearly see how that, whether it's 5 minutes later or 5 hours later or 5 days later or 5 years later, is setting up a series of cause and conditions which will be unfolding. We can all do that, can't we? If we're willing to step back, to turn the energy of mindfulness in that direction, so we can all, again, please understand that even though in these couple of pages we read in these descriptions of the assemblies of Bodhisattvas, all their practices and all their trainings and all their abilities and characteristics are presented fully manifested, because these are deeply realized Bodhisattvas, it doesn't mean those of us who are treading the same path but are not as realized cannot see in small ways the seeds and seedlings, the nascent capacity, potentiality within ourselves for each and every one of these characteristics that are being enumerated in this Vimalakirti Sutra. Please do not sit here as if you're hearing something so fantastic, right? That you go, well, that's them, but not me. That's your little mind trying to keep you little. That's that I won't grow up mind telling you you can never be an adult. This is the full expression of adulthood. And we all have the capacity, because we all have those seeds within us, and we can be cultivated. Though they had firmly closed the gate to all manner of evil existences, yet they allowed themselves to be born in the five lower realms, manifesting themselves there so they might act as great physician kings, adroitly healing the ills of others, doling out whatever medicine suited the ailment, and ensuring that the patient took it as prescribed. Wonderful. So that's, again, a description of the marvelous activity of a bodhisattva, right? Their aim in life is not comfort and pleasure. Their aim in life is to be benefiting others. That is their aim. And depending on the type of bodhisattva they are, depending on their causes and conditions, depending on the strength of their realization, they have the capacity to go into quote-unquote lower realms. Right? Lower realms are what? Realms of great suffering. Realms of great delusion. Realms of great anger. Realms of great sadness. Realms of great fear. Realms of great ignorance and stupidity. And they're capable of going to all these quote-unquote lower realms, not to be sucked into it, as probably the rest of us would be, but they can go in these realms. And the analogy is a physician, right? Physicians go where? Nurses go where? They go to places of sickness, don't they? They don't go to places of health. Right? If you were a young doctor and you were setting up your practice, you wouldn't pick the healthiest place in the country where nobody was sick. No business there. You'd probably look around and go, where is it just a ton of illness and not too many doctors and nurses? That's a good place to set up practice. I'll be very busy. I'll do well. What bodhisattvas do. They look around and they go, where are people really sick? Where is there lots of illness? And where can I go and bring comfort, bring aid, give medicine, nurse, take care of, and help heal and transform these beings who are suffering so. And then, for a page, their names are listed. What? No, not all of them. They list a good number, and then they say there were 32,000 bodhisattvas such as these. But there were like bodhisattvas viewing equality, bodhisattvas viewing inequality, bodhisattva viewing equality and inequality, bodhisattva meditation, freedom king, bodhisattva dharma form, shining form, bodhisattva great adornment, bodhisattva accumulation of eloquence, bodhisattva constantly raised hand, bodhisattva constantly extended hand, bodhisattva constantly commiserating, bodhisattva joyful capacity, bodhisattva lion roar, thunder sound, bodhisattva mountain from smiting sound, bodhisattva running elephant. Bodhisattva white running elephant. Bodhisattva constant exertion. Bodhisattva flower adornment. Bodhisattva perceiver of the world sound. That's a bhakti for all of us in attendance. Bodhisattva Brahma's net. Bodhisattva like that. Bodhisattva golden locks was there. Golden locks. bodhisattva golden locks was there, bodhisattva gemmed locks was there, and as we know, the great bodhisattva of the Buddha-to-be, bodhisattva Maitreya was there, and bodhisattva Dharma prince Manjushri was there. They were all there, plus 32 other thousands such as these. In addition, there were 10,000 Brahma kings. There were also 12,000 other Hindu gods. In addition, there were other heavenly beings of great authority and power, as well as dragons, spirits, yakshas, gandharvas, asuras, garudas, kinnaras, maharagas, and others. This is the whole cosmology of ancient India. And all the beings of all the worlds also arrived to take their seats in assemblies with the various monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. Interesting, right? In the Pali Sutras, right, the monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen, the fourfold sangha is what is present. Here, they're like an afterthought. Right? This is drama, this is poetry, but there's a meaning. There's a vastness in it. And a sense of the aliveness of the universe and the great benefit this practice has. Not just only to us, men and women, monks and nuns, but to all beings and spirits and plants and animals, seen and unseen. So you can see there is a vastness of interconnection that is unfolding here. And we, 28 or 30 of us sitting here, we're also part of this assembly. So at that time the Buddha, reverently surrounded by this multitude of countless hundreds and thousands of beings, expounded the Dharma for them. He was like Mount Sumeru, king of mountains, rising up. This is ancient cosmic theology of the four continents of Mount Sumeru. This is the ancient way the world is looked at. He was like Mount Sumeru, king of the mountains, rising up out of the great sea, resting at ease in his lion seat, clustered with jewels. He shed his radiance over all the great throng gathered. Everybody gets a say. Please use your imagination. Thousands and thousands. All the Buddha on his lion throne, encrusted with jewels, totally at ease, rousing like Mount Everest. At that time, a man, and here's jeweled accumulation, the son of a wealthy man of the city of Vasili, came along with 500 other sons of wealthy men. Lots of numbers, yeah. Nobody went alone in those days. Always a crowd. And so they all came to the Buddha with parasols, bowing their heads in abeyance. Before the feet of the Buddha, they offer these jeweled parasols as alms to the Buddha. Now the Buddha does, the Buddha then with his supernatural powers caused all the 500 jeweled parasols to come together and form one single parasol that spread over the entire 1,000,000,000-fold world. Long before the Hubble, long before astronomers, they knew the vastness of this universe. Forgive me for saying universe. Universes, endless, boundless universes. This is all here in these Mahayana sutras. Endless worlds. No beginning, no end. Right? Of which this human world, I think it's called Jamyudandipa or something. Just a tiny little dot. That's why they have these hundreds of thousands of all kinds of beings. Because in this Buddhist cosmology, endless warnings, endless classifications of beings, people incarnating, reincarnating, rebirth. Anyway, life is everywhere. Mm-hmm. 2,500 years ago, they understood this. They didn't have the hubris to think, in all this vast universe, we are the only one conscious. Look at that possibility. So he got he showed his supernatural, again, in the Mahayana Sutras, there are these supernatural things going on. So he took their 500 and he made one single parasol that spread over the entire 1,000,000,000-fold world. All the vast features of that world were visible. All the mountains of this 1,000,000,000-fold world, snow mountains, regular mountains, jewel mountains, gold mountains, black mountains. Encircling the mountains were huge seas, rivers, watercourses, brooks and streams, fountains and springs, as well as endless suns and moons and stars, constellations, heavenly palaces, dragon palaces, and the palaces of the venerable spirits, all were seen within the jeweled parasol. And the Buddhas of the 10 directions, the Buddhas as they preached the Dharma, these too were visible within the jeweled parasol. At this time, all the members of the Great Assembly, witnessing this manifestation of the Buddha's powers, sighed in admiration at what they had never seen before. Pressing their palms together, they made obeisance to the Buddha, gazing up in reverence at the face of the Honored One and never taking their eyes from him. There are 146 pages, and we're page 21. Of course, we started at page 17. But you can see why it's hard to cut anything out. There is such profundity, such meaning, and the mind that created these teachings for us. We have to believe that any being that could express such profound wisdom and understanding so eloquently kind of knew what they were up to. We have to respect their intelligence and why they presented these teachings in this way. So that being the case, it's hard to skip over things or pick and choose. But maybe we'll do a little over these next days. So please take the spirit of what was shared with us today in the sutra, and please take it with you into your practice today as we move through walking meditation, lunch, rest, more meditation, mindful movements, solitary practice, deep sharing, dinner, the unfolding of the day. Please take the spirit of Inlet Tricky with you, the spirit of the Bodhisattva with you, and understand that moment to moment, whatever you are doing, there is some aspect of the Buddhist path, the Bodhisattva path, that you are cultivating. The opportunity is always right before us. Again, we have good conditions here, a lot of support. So please practice well.